Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for The Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We are off to the frigid winds of Alaska today and to the excitement and incredible test of endurance, which is the Iditarod. And perhaps you have heard at least a little bit about this daunting gauntlet, which is a dog sled race like none other. And we get to experience the punishing challenge which the Iditarod represents in an amazing new book called Fast Into the Night, A Woman, Her Dogs, and Their Journey North on the Iditarod Trail. This is something which Debbie Motoro experienced at the age of 47 as a mother of two. And it was not an easy thing to accomplish, but accomplish it she did. And as she shares the story with us in this exciting book, we come to know and love each and every one of these dogs that made this possible. Debbie Motoro actually ran the Iditarod more than once, and dog racing runs deep into her family. And we hear about that as well, and some other really touching personal stories as well. There is so much that makes this an incredibly compelling book. Again, it's called Fast Into the Night, A Woman, Her Dogs, and Their Journey North on the Iditarod Trail, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And Debbie Clark Motoro, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to talk to you this morning.
Glad that we can do this. Could you very briefly sketch your life's path, which eventually took you to Alaska?
You bet. I grew up in New England, spent a lot of time in Vermont, Cape Cod. My parents took me to Wyoming. Wild places were definitely the favorite in our household, all generations, and when I graduated from college, I did move to Wyoming. I was invited on a mountain climbing expedition in Alaska, and I went to Alaska for what I thought would be 10 days. I met my husband on that trip. We got married the following winter, and Alaska's been our home ever since 1979, when all that happened.
I wonder if we could just take a moment to have you sketch one of the most interesting and harrowing stories which occurs that has nothing to do with dog sledding, but has a lot to do with the perils of Alaska. It involves your fall into a crevice and suffering some serious injuries, and you actually were probably lucky. That story could have ended much worse than it did.
I was very, very lucky. I had just spent a much more technical time climbing in the Alaska Range, which is in formerly Mount McKinley, Denali, climbing and skiing on the glaciers. And Mark and I went on what was supposed to be a day excursion into the mountains, and we were walking on a glacier before it got steep, and I slipped and fell into a crevasse unroped. And I don't even like telling this story because it was definitely one of my, it's a little embarrassing. Looking back, of course, I was young, immortal. We were about to rope up. There didn't seem to be any danger before that. But boy, that was a wake-up call to me that I was incredibly lucky to come out of that one alive.
Well, it obviously didn't ultimately tame your sense of adventure, because ultimately, of course, you end up experiencing an extraordinary kind of adventure that most of us can scarcely even dream of. How did dog racing first enter sort of the collective life of your small family, of you and your husband and your two children there in Alaska?
Well, we adopted a retired Iditarod sled dog, and we fell madly in love with this dog. His name was Salt. Our children were 5 and 6 at the time, I believe. And Salt really took us on skis. He would tow the kids behind him. He would tow me behind him. The sport is called ski touring, where you ski behind a dog, and it's pulling you. And before you know it, our children wanted more dogs so they could go into little junior races, the 1-dog class, the 2-dog class. They got older, there was the 3- and 5-dog class. So the numbers of huskies grew in our household.
I wonder
how it all began.
Right. I think it is really telling that, and it is part of what makes this book really remarkable, that you tell us the point in your life when this beautiful dog named Salt came into your life. It came at a very, very low point when you and your husband had suffered something truly heartbreaking. Can you just say a quick word about that?
You bet. I had just experienced a well into my pregnancy miscarriage, and I was pretty down in the dumps. It actually happened to me 3 times, and it really threw me. You know, I'm pretty resilient, and I know that no one is immune from life's heartaches, so I really tried to work through it, but Salt was actually a present, a gift to me from a friend who was a musher, knowing that I was kind of in a dark place, and he thought that the dog might turn my world around, and I don't think he had any idea what the dog would do to all of us.
Right. You recount the story of when Salt first came into your house, literally, and you were very resistant to the idea, and yet Salt did something which caused you to laugh for the first time in months.
Salt walked. I told our friend not to come over, and he said, "I'm coming. If you don't like this dog, you can return him to me in a week. Just, we're coming. My wife and I are coming over. We're bringing you this dog." And my mother was visiting, and she said, "Oh, what do you want an old husky for? I bet he's not even housebroken." Well, that got the rebel in me going a little. I said, "Of course he's housebroken, Mom," knowing full well he probably wasn't. And he came in the door, trotted right to the Christmas tree, and lifted his leg. And that was the beginning of our life with Salt.
Right. And I think it's really interesting in a slightly later chapter when you talk about Salt being, in a sense, a mentor to younger dogs. But also he represented for you something else, of course, kind of a path out of your deepest sorrow. At one point you say, "To Salt I confided my deep maternal sorrow." And I think, mm-hmm. you know, even for someone who's not been exactly where you are or experienced what you were experiencing then, I think just about any of us who own dogs that we love and who we feel love us have experienced at least something like that.
Yeah, well, I remember this vividly, actually. It's not in the book, but there was a day right in there when Salt ran off one day, and I was absolutely devastated. Well, he turned out he was at the neighbor's house looking for their chickens, but I that dog was very, very sacred to me. He really was. For, you know, he represents the beginning of our kennel, which has sustained us in many different times and ways and adventures, but boy, that bond with Salt was something I will never, ever forget.
Hmm. We are speaking with Debbie Clark Motoro, and we're talking about her new book, Fast Into the Night, A Woman, Her Dogs, and Their Journey North on the Iditarod Trail. It was actually your son, Andy, who experienced the wonder and joy and glory of running an Iditarod well before you did. And you tell us about his experience and how exhilarating it was for him to finish. And his words to you at the finish line when you first embraced were what?
He said to me, I watched my son run under the burled arch in Nome, the finish line. I had never dreamt of doing Iditarod, and I was so thrilled with the smile on his face. His dogs were just charging and happy. He threw his arms around me, and he said, "Mom, you have to do this." And honestly, I had never, ever thought of running Iditarod before. I was busy raising kids, having fun in shorter races. Mark and I loved to go camping with the dogs. We introduced some friends to the sport. But when Andy said that, I think that the whole lifestyle, our dogs had meant so much to us. Both Andy and his sister Hannah were going off to college in the next 2 years, leaving 22 dogs in the backyard. And I thought, by golly, I guess I will. That was the beginning of my Iditarod journey.
Say a quick word about the creation of the Iditarod in 1973. I think it says something about the race and the mystique that surrounds it that a lot of us sort of just assume that this has been around for hundreds of years. I mean, there is something sort of primeval about what this experience is and what an accomplishment it is to complete it successfully. It's actually a relatively new creation. Tell us just a brief word about its creation and how it stands apart from other dog races.
Well, Joe Reddington had this great interest in the dogs of the North, and mostly in the trail that had been used for centuries that crossed Alaska. It had been used for many different purposes. The most famous might be the Serum Run delivery in 1925. But dogs had been used in this northern land long before that to help the native people of Alaska live in the winter, trapping and moving, and really for transportation. And, of course, the Gold Rush history is another aspect of the dogs and the trail. Joe Reddington wanted to honor that tradition, and toward that end, he started the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race. Now it's really taken on a life of its own, but it was really to honor the dogs and the land.
Explain exactly how the race works, sort of the nuts and bolts of it.
You bet. You start the first Saturday of March. Iditarod starts every year. You follow a course that is marked by 22 checkpoints between here and Nome, Alaska, which is on the coast of the Bering Sea. I'm in Anchorage this morning. You have some mandatory rests that you need to take along the way. There's a 24-hour mandatory rest. There's several other rests that you need to take, but basically, each musher starts with, these days, 16 dogs, and it's up to you to train for your particular race in a run-rest schedule that you devise with your team in months and months and usually thousands of miles training in preparation for it. At every checkpoint, there are veterinarians. Dogs are given physicals every stop along the way. You can, what we call, drop dogs. You can leave dogs in the hands of veterinarians to fly home. If they're tired, if they have maybe a sore wrist or something, the point is to leave them in good hands and get them home safe and sound before a soreness really turns into a real injury. And you can proceed, but you cannot add any dogs to your team.
One other
detail, you send provisions out to each of those 22 checkpoints. So you're picking up supplies for you and the dogs along the way.
So in a sense, you're picking up your own provisions.
Absolutely. Picking up human food, dog food, extra gear, whatever it is that you use to care for the animals.
And these are provisions that you have purchased and arranged for and sent ahead.
That's right. It's called drop bags. You send them out in drop bags. And the deadline when drop bags actually are the blueprint for your race. What you send out there is what you have. Those are your resources to get from point A in Anchorage to 1,000 miles later to Nome.
One little point of complication, in a sense, is the fact that you were heading out on this Iditarod with a team of 16 dogs. And explain to our listeners how this marked a somewhat dramatic departure from what you were used to.
Well, I weigh 120 pounds, so 16 dogs is not a number of dogs I casually run in training. You know, I'm usually running an 8, 10, maybe a 12-dog team. So, but you start with 16 on a trip of this length because, you know, you want to have enough dogs so that in the end you have a good, strong team if you have to leave a few. The key to this whole thing is your relation to the dogs and the dogs' relation to one another. And you bring with you on that line a bunch of circumstances and familiarities for yourself and the dogs, but then there's some unknowns. What's it like to be out there for 14 days running at all times of the day? What's it like on the Bering Sea coast when there isn't a tree in sight and you can't tell which way is up, down, or sideways? What's it like in a wind that's hurricane strength? You might or might not run into that. You don't normally train in that sort of a circumstance. So there's a very, very intimate dynamic between the musher and the dogs, and then a big set of variables about what you might experience out there and how collectively you'll deal with that.
One of the things that was really odd about this first Iditarod that you ran or run, I'm not sure what the verb is I'm supposed to use.
No, we use ran.
Okay. although it's mostly the dogs who do the running, of course. But this was a case in which, for the first time in the race's 30-year history, it was 30 years old at that point, the trail, which had always been, I think, essentially the exact same trail, had to be changed, and rather dramatically changed. Explain what the trail usually is, but what the trail turned out to be in 2003.
Usually the trail begins in south central Alaska near Anchorage and goes up and over the Alaska Range in the first 200 miles. Then it follows the Yukon River, and then it goes along the coast to Nome. There was no snow that winter, much like last winter. And so the race was relocated to begin in Fairbanks. That's north of the mountain range. So the race took place entirely on rivers for the most part until the coast. There was no crossing of the treacherous country that there usually is in the beginning. And river running is relatively mild, but it is somewhat monotonous for that many miles.
And it's interesting because that also, that monotony posed some real challenges in terms of being able to successfully and safely complete the course. I mean, monotony can be your enemy.
It was interesting that year. The rate of teams that pulled out of the race when they were still on the river was incredibly high. And most mushers agreed that it was really the lack of variety. You know, the Yukon River is mile wide in places. And to do that day after day after day really did take its toll on the morale of mushers and their dogs. And, of course, the dogs are reflecting the mushers' swings and vice versa. And so it's difficult to really understand what happens when a dog team loses their drive, but the fallout rate on that race was very, very high.
Hmm. Early in the book, so early in the Iditarod, you say this: "Now as the dogs click along the winding trail, condensation from their warm breath billows above the gangline. It's mesmerizing to watch them move through the dimming light, but I catch myself. Nothing about marathon dog sledding around the clock is second nature." explain the many ways in which that is true and that it is so much more than just standing on that little platform and letting the dogs carry you. I mean, there is so much more involved that it requires intense focus and preparation.
Well, it's really, think of the difference between jogging a mile and jogging 26 miles. You know, you have to keep going. You have to find a pace that's sustainable. You have your own mood swings. Normally, as a rookie, and particularly the passage that you read right there, that was my very first Iditarod. Well, it was my first Iditarod. And, you know, your first marathon is your first marathon. There's a whole lot of sleep deprivation, of nutrition, of run-rest schedule, that you've not experienced before, and you need to just work your way through it. That's part of the draw, but it's also part of the, it also is the heart of the challenge.
Right. It's interesting that right after you mentioned this, I mean, going through this almost sort of frantic checklist of all the things that you hope you have with you, all the things that you hope are in good working order and so on, then suddenly you realize that you haven't passed a trail marker in quite some time, and you are faced with the really daunting possibility that you are off the trail. And I think a lot of us, when we sort of imagine something like the Iditarod, don't even think about that really scary possibility. Explain how the trail is marked and how it is that you know, in a sense, where to go.
Well, they're trail markers. I think they put something like, I don't know, they put several thousand trail markers out there. But you can go for a good half mile and not see one. You can also get on a stretch of trail, and maybe the marker's been knocked over by a team that went around a bend a little too close to the marker. I mean, you can't control that. So as time goes on, you definitely can go for a good half hour, sometimes an hour, without seeing a trail marker. And, of course, I wrote a lot of the book about that territory between daring and doubt, which I definitely put on the page. That was my wrestling match out there, and I would dare say it's probably everybody's to one extent or the other. And there were several times where I've thought in many races, oh, my gosh, am I off the trail? It is not a panic that I might be lost. You might think so, but we have provisions to camp, to be there for a long time. There's extra food for the dogs and myself in the sled. You don't want to be lost, but to figure out how to reverse course and where you could have gone wrong, these are the things that immediately you shift into a different way of thinking. Okay, how long will I wait until I stop and turn around? Mm. And, you know, if it's snowing, something like that, you have to really have your wits about you.
Mm. You introduce us to all of your dogs, I mean, the dogs that you are taking on this Iditarod run, and it's really fascinating, first of all, to get a sense of each of their unique personalities and also the particular role that each of these dogs play within the team. Just say a quick word about the intricacy of all that, because it obviously is a very crucial element in whether or not a dog sled team is ultimately going to be successful.
Right. Well, every team has leaders, and they're the dogs at the front of the line, and these are confident dogs that really relish having the first sight around the bend in a trail. Right behind them are swing dogs, and usually those are also leaders that you could switch out. Then you have team dogs all the way back to the wheel dogs, and the wheel dogs have a very, very particular job. They're responsible for pulling you around, say, an obstacle that you don't want to hit. You know, it's basically a line almost like you play crack the whip, and you're on the end. So the wheel dogs need to be particularly honest dogs, agile on their feet to keep you safe and keep the team straightened out. The dynamic on the line between those dogs, some of them are best friends with one another. Some of them don't care much for each other. Some are quicker than others, but if you put your really fast leaders out, are you going to upset the dog that needs a slower pace? Then it's up to the musher to temper the speed. This really isn't about speed. It's about momentum and dog management and dog interaction.
And you know what's really interesting, and we're not going to reveal how the race ultimately ends and too much about the specific adventures that you experience. We leave that to our listeners to look at your wonderful book. But one of the thoughts you share at the very, very end of the book is this about your dogs. You write, "I can never know exactly what they're thinking. That's the reality that distinguishes us and defines the mystery that draws us together as one." And I really appreciate you saying that, because I think, on the one hand, you obviously know these dogs so well, know, in a sense, their emotional makeup and so on. And yet, it's a good reminder at the end of the book that you ultimately cannot know exactly what's going on in the mind of each and every one of these dogs. And that's also part of what ratchets up the challenge of all this.
Well, that's the heart of it. You know, I mean, it's a matter of communication, and they are another species. You know, my my brother said, don't write a book about furry little people. I want to read a dog book. And I really respect that. You know, the dogginess of the dogs is undeniable, and it's a wonderful thing. And to interact with another species, I think, really offers not only a glimpse into, in this case, the canine world and perspective, but I think it teaches us a lot about what it might mean to be human. You know, it's very, very rich. I'm just the luckiest person in the world to have done this with these dogs and to share my days with them. And I really wanted to honor the dogs in the writing of this book, so I hope that comes across.
It really does. More than once in the book, you say that the dogs are the real heroes of something like the Iditarod. But I also appreciate the fact that you talk so much about also what these dogs offer you off of the trail, like when you talk about Salt offering you quiet, inquisitive companionship, steadying your world. Mm-hmm. All of us who have dogs and love dogs can really identify with that. The book, again, is Fast Into the Night, A Woman, Her Dogs, and Their Journey North on the Iditarod Trail, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Debbie Clark Motoro, thank you so much for writing this wonderful book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Thank you so much. What an honor to talk to you. I really, really appreciate it.
Coming up in part two of today's Morning Show from the Archives, you'll hear my conversation with the very gifted novelist responsible for The Devil Wears Prada, talking about one of her more recent novels. A quick reminder that coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, two really interesting interviews, one of them with a gentleman named Todd Rose, who has written a very, very intriguing book called The End of Average, which looks at the ways in which we tend to very much misuse the whole notion or concept of average, particularly in the way that we tend to rank ourselves as above or below average and the way we design the things that we use all the time. It is his contention that we need to think much more about the individual. Also, we will be hearing tomorrow from somebody from the Fifth House Ensemble, that marvelous chamber group from Chicago, who will be performing in the Fine Arts at First concert this Sunday afternoon. That will be part two of tomorrow's Morning Show here on WGTD. I am very, very excited about the next few minutes because I am speaking with novelist Lauren Weisberger, and I am sure many of you know her for the novel The Devil Wears Prada, which, of course, was a huge bestseller and also made into a very, very successful motion picture starring Meryl Streep. Lauren Weisberger's latest novel is called Last Night at Chateau Marmont, and in it we follow the ups and downs of a man and wife as one of them works very, very hard in a relatively mundane life of a nutritionist, while the husband is working towards musical success and then begins to score exactly that in spectacular fashion. But it is a whirlwind the two of them find themselves in, and their marriage is buffeted on all sides by the kind of pressures that most of us can't begin to understand. Again, this latest novel is called Last Night at Chateau Marmont. It is published by Atria, and I'm very excited to have Lauren Weisberger with me on the phone for the next few minutes to talk about this and some of her other work. Lauren Weisberger, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Really appreciate this. If there is a hallmark in quite a lot of what you have written, it is that there are more than faint echoes of your own real-life experiences. Of course, I think many people know that about The Devil Wears Prada, that in so many ways that was an echo of some of your own experiences working at Vogue magazine. But that's by no means the only indication of this or echoes of your real life. Talk for a moment about how you do that as an author, the kinds of things which you are compelled to draw upon from your own life and how you choose to do that.
Well, I probably like every author out there, you know, I certainly do write what I know. And as you said with The Devil Wears Prada, a lot of that book was informed by my experiences working at Vogue. Certainly a lot of my job there was of the more mundane type of tasks, the kind of faxing and filing and coffee fetching that I then, you know, tried to exaggerate and embellish and make more over the top, although not that there wasn't plenty of that going on already. But with the books that have followed Prada, so much of that has honestly been just looking at, you know, my own life, my own friends, my own family, mining them for good stories, if you will. You know, I have a lot of my girlfriends are out there in different professions, doing different things, meeting different people, and girls love to talk over dinner. So we do a lot of talking and a lot of storytelling. And I would say that a good deal of the material comes from my closest girlfriends. And as far as Last Night at Chateau Marmont, this current book, a lot of that was my interest in this celebrity culture. You know, it's something that just continues to fascinate me why we are so fascinated by it. So I thought it would be something, you know, a good topic to explore for this book.
Absolutely. I make note of also that a short story you've written called The Bamboo Confessions, which I'm really anxious to read but have not yet thus far, is about someone who essentially backpacks all over the world. And if I remember correctly, that is also something that is part of your own personal experience.
It is, yes. It feels like a long time ago now that I was doing that. I did that right out of college, and it was probably the best couple months imaginable to just kind of throw on a backpack and head out. It was really, really fantastic.
Hmm. Before we dig into some specifics of this latest novel, I want to ask you about something which you say in the acknowledgments when you thank, among other people, your editorial dream team. And you say every author should know what it's like to be on the receiving end of such smart, savvy, and sensitive feedback. I wonder if you would just say a word about the experience of being edited, particularly as someone who experienced tremendous success very, very, very early in their career. What it was like then, what it's like now to have your books examined not only by, of course, the general public, the buying public, but before we even see the book, by this so-called editorial dream team.
Right. Well, thank God that these books are not examined by the general public before they're examined by the editor or the editors in this case. In the beginning, it was a process I found very intimidating and overwhelming. The idea of turning over, especially with a first book, something you'd been working on and you're not sure if it's exactly right or if it's exactly what they're looking for, and this extremely senior-ranking person at Doubleday who's edited 1,000 books is going to tell you, you know, are you headed in the right direction, and if not, how you might be able to. So I found all of that quite terrifying, but the beauty of working with an editor is developing a relationship, and it's such an intimate, personal relationship. It's just the two of you. You're working on this project together. They know the book inside and out, every bit as well as you, the author, does. And it's a neat team effort. They're 100% on your side. They want nothing more than to make the book better. And it's a really collaborative, cool, different relationship. So it's really become something that I depend on more than anything. And beyond your main editor, where you're discussing plot and characters, story ideas, certainly structure and pacing, all of the bigger ideas, you have you work with a bunch of other people who probably don't get applauded as much as they should, but people like the copy editors who make sure it's readable and mistake-free from page 1 to page 400, which could not be more important.
Hmm. One last quick question. We don't have to go into this a lot, but could you just say a word about the challenge of following up on that first blockbuster? I mean, I think that's a challenge for any writer, but you were really, really young and really, really inexperienced. And in some respects, your new novel is an echo of that experience of suddenly being famous. And not only does one have to sort of handle all that comes with that in terms of just the way your life changes, but the maybe most essential challenge is to follow up on that first great success. Could you just speak a word about that?
Yeah, you know, it was with everything that happened with Prada, which was my first book. It was so heady and overwhelming and wonderful in so many different ways, but it was definitely a shock to the system. I had not been prepared for the terrific reception that the book received, and I was sort of thrown into this whirlwind. And after that, like you said, I think the sophomore effort for any author is a frightening one. You spend so long working on one book, and you can never imagine, at least I could never imagine, the book that would follow it. But, you know, it was scary, but it was a terrific experience to be able to sit down and sort of say to yourself, I do have a story, I want to work on these characters, and, you know, I think if I give it my all, I think I can make this work, you know, with a lot of help from a lot of other people. I remember it being vaguely terrifying, but sort of getting over the hump of that second book was really important. And after that, I won't say it gets any easier. It's always intimidating to look at a blank screen, but you start to understand the process a little bit more, which I think helps.
We're speaking with Lauren Weisberger, and we're about to start talking about her latest novel, which is called Last Night at Chateau Marmont. The book focuses on a young couple, Brooke and Julian, and such an interesting couple they are, and two characters that we like a lot and so much want to see succeed in every respect. Tell us a bit about how you shaped these two characters and the specifics that bring them to life, and especially to what extent either Brooke or Julian are a really direct reflection of you and some of what you've experienced.
Such a good question. You know, fundamentally, Brooke and Julian, I want people to think of them as an every couple, because that's really how they are, sort of before all of this happens to them. They've been married for 5 years. She's working hard as a nutritionist. She wants to open up her own business one day, and he's a struggling musician, and he's sort of working the gig scene in New York and trying to catch a break. They're just two regular young people who are trying to make it work. I think we all know couples like that or are part of couples like that. But all of a sudden, even though he's been working on this for many, many years, he gets a big break that launches him in what feels like an overnight fashion into international superstardom. And there's a lot of perks that come with that. There's no denying it. There's private planes, and there's posh parties, and there's a lot of celebrities, and there's free clothes, and there's sort of endless fun things, new experiences to enjoy. But it comes at a really, really steep price, which it takes Brooke and Julian a little time to figure out. And soon they realize they've sacrificed, you know, all semblance of their life before. They're being followed by paparazzi, and throngs of screaming girls follow him wherever he goes. And every time they pick up a tabloid or an entertainment magazine, they find some new horrible story planted about them, and they're not sure by whom or why. It's just a complete loss of privacy. And for me, it was an interesting story to write. I think, while maybe not a lot of women can necessarily relate to the husband being a famous rock star element of it, you know, I think a lot of people can relate to wanting something for so long and working for it for so long. And when you finally do get it, whatever it is, it often doesn't look the way you pictured. And it's sort of coming to grips with that, dealing with that.
I wonder if you could speak a moment about this notion of a new celebrity being suddenly part of a machine that exists to simply perpetuate that celebrity, and of a human being suddenly becoming almost like a part in a huge gadget, and especially sort of being surrounded by the people who are part of that machine, and to some extent excluding other important people from that new celebrity's life. I mean, is that something you have seen firsthand? I mean, in what ways does that, in fact, really happen?
You know, it's certainly not anything I experienced myself, you know, writing a book that people thankfully really responded to and wanted to buy copies of is a totally different stratosphere than what Julian is experiencing, in the fact that he can barely walk outside without being harassed by any one of a number of people. So I wouldn't say that it was informed, you know, so much by my own experience, but it did make me think about, you know, kind of what role we all play in this. You know, I'll be the first to admit that I'm standing in my lobby every week waiting for my copy of Us Weekly to come in the mail. It's definitely a guilty pleasure. I love sort of flipping through and looking at the pictures and reading the captions and seeing what everyone's up to. And my sister and I probably spend more time than we should discussing these people's lives as though they're our friends, instead of complete strangers. But I kept trying to imagine maybe what it would be like to be on the other end of that. And not so much the stars that have been famous for their entire careers, not so much an Angelina Jolie or Jennifer Aniston, who I imagine don't follow these magazines or read what's written about them, and they have to operate in a sort of world outside of that one. But what it would be like if you were sort of thrust into this world, not against your will, but you're sort of along for someone else's ride, and yet you're a moving target the same way they are. How would that feel, and how would you deal with it?
Did anything in particular prompt you to choose Brooke's particular occupation? She is a nutritionist and one that works back-breaking hours. And you set that in, of course, contrast to what her husband Julian is experiencing in this skyrocketing musical career of his. Did anything in particular draw you to that specific choice?
You know, it was just a couple of factors. I didn't want her in any of the careers I have typically given my characters in the past, which seem to be media and fashion and public relations related. I wanted her working on something that was completely and totally separate from this whole world, a career that could easily take place in any city, in any state, not something New York specific, not something that has anything to do with LA. So that was a consideration. And then beyond that, there's obviously a lot of choices. Then a very dear friend of mine is a nutritionist, and I'm always interested when she tells me about the cases she sees and what she does and who she works with. Plus, from the standpoint of having access to someone very easy to interview for an education in this world, it was a clear choice.
We see Brooke not only contrasted with her husband, but also with some of the other women in her life. And right at the beginning of the book, we're privy to a conversation between she and her friend Nola. And at one point you have Brooke thinking to herself, it was impossible to keep track of Nola's man situation from week to week, not just which one, a challenge in itself, but whether she desperately wanted a boyfriend to settle down with or loathed commitment and wanted only to be single and fabulous and sleeping around. It changed on a dime with no warning and left Brooke constantly trying to remember whether this week's guy was so amazing or a total disaster. I wonder if there are the faintest of echoes of that in your own life or, in fact, in this circle of girlfriends, which you've already mentioned in the interview, that for some of them this is a reality, that this is kind of the heart and soul of who they are in terms of a woman wanting or not wanting a relationship with a man.
Right. That's such an interesting question. You know, I wouldn't say that, certainly not myself, and I wouldn't say that any of my close girlfriends really resemble Nola in that clear of a way, but I will say that I think a lot of women, all of us included, in their 20s definitely go back and forth with the sort of age-old question of, do I want to be in a relationship or do I want to be sort of out there and meeting a lot of new people and going on different dates every week and, you know, how, what fits better at what stage I'm at in my life right now. So, you know, I probably took it to another level with Nola. I definitely did. But it just sort of fit her personality to me. And I do think that we all know someone like that, someone who's sort of wildly fluctuating between the two. You know, there's no gray area for these women. Everything is just absolutely phenomenal or totally disastrous. And, you know, that whole concept sort of makes me smile.
Sure. And it's an interesting echo of course, even for Brooke and Julian, that on the one hand, they've wanted this great success, which is at last his, and yet it proves to be not exactly what they wanted at all. And that story and many others woven together into this compelling novel, Last Night at Chateau Marmont, and the author, Lauren Weisberger. Lauren Weisberger, I thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show, and we wish you very well.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. This is great.
Well, the theme doesn't want to play, so it's 8:56 here on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. There's the theme. I think it's going to play correctly now. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, as we mentioned earlier, you'll hear two interviews. The first will be with author Todd Rose, who's written a very intriguing book called The End of Average. He begins the book with a really interesting story about the U.S. Air Force in the 1940s. They were experiencing many crashes due to pilot error, and they were trying to figure out what in the world was going on. It finally occurred to them to make sure that they had properly designed the cockpits of some of these new aircraft, and they realized, due to the insights of one thoughtful man, that these cockpits were being designed for the so-called average pilot, but absolutely nobody actually fit the bill as being average. And so there were all kinds of pilots going up in the air in ill-fitting cockpits. And they believed this led to all of these unfortunate and unnecessary crashes. It's just one of a number of insights which have led Todd Rose to believe that we think way too much about the whole notion of average. And he is part of a new movement in the sciences of the science of individuality, which seeks to discard the paradigm of the average in favor of looking at people in their full complexity as individuals. And that's what he explores in his fascinating new book called The End of Average. In part two of The Morning Show, I'll speak with Melissa Snoza, who is with the Fifth House Ensemble, a marvelous chamber music group based in Chicago, who will be performing this Sunday afternoon at First United Methodist Church as part of the next concert of the Fine Arts at First series. So we look forward to that conversation very much. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, WGTD.org. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for The Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Well, our weather forecast, despite the sunshine we're having right now, is for cloudy skies, windy conditions, and some more snow showers. Maybe another inch of accumulation with a high today of 23 degrees and rather brisk winds. Cloudy and cold overnight, light snow and a low of 7 above. Partly sunny and tomorrow's high just 14 degrees. This is WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake